great pleasure to introduce to you a lady who has been an inspiration to me in my program of Al-Anon. She is a lady who has been around for a long time. She started one of the very first Al-Anon meetings in Southern California around the year 1935. She's from Laguna Beach in Southern California, and at this time I would like to introduce you all to Elsa C.
My name is Elsa C., and I am a very, very contented and happy, most of the time, Al-Anon. Thank you. And I'm human, and I go up and down like a yo-yo. And you'd think, after being alone as long as I have, that I would have it really made, wouldn't you? Because I've been here for a long, long time, and I did not start the first meeting of Al-Anon in Southern California. I started one of the first meetings, and so there were a number of others started at the same time. But I'm happy to be back here again. I was here 7 or 8 years ago and enjoyed the acquaintances that I made then very, very much. Can you all hear me okay? I've been doing some things lately that I didn't used to think that I should do, because I was so afraid you'd think I was bragging. But I have come to the belief that if you're telling your story, you've got to tell it like it was, or you're not being valid. So if it sounds as though I'm laying it on a little thick, think nothing of it, because that's the way it was. I'm an old lady. I've been around an awful long time. And I am glad to be back in this area again because, you see, I was born in San Francisco. And I was born before the earthquake. And I can remember very well feeling the shaking. And that didn't scare me half as much as the fires did. And they made a lasting impression on me that I wasn't able to get rid of for many, many years, because I'm deathly afraid of fire. And I can remember so well crawling in with my mother for years and years and years afterwards, because I was so young at the time. But I'm glad to be back here, but there's some things that I want to tell you that may give a background for why I became what I became. And I think that's what you all were here wanting to know about. How come you got that way? And the only way I can tell you is by saying that I'm an only child. I have never had any brothers or sisters. I wish I had. I'd give anything in the world if I had brothers and sisters, but I don't. So I grew up a stubborn, bull-headed, pig-headed kid that my mother and father used to say, "That head of yours is solid bone." So I had a lot of things to learn, a lot of things to learn. And strangely enough, when I got old enough to graduate from grammar school, I went to a school that a lot of you have heard a great deal about, and that's Hollywood High School. At that time, we lived at the edge of Los Angeles, where just off a few blocks from where the Wilshire Country Club is today, if any of you are familiar with Los Angeles at all. And I was stubborn enough that I would not ride my bicycle to high school. It was a long way, because my mother and father thought that I should be able to save that car fare at least, and it was stupid not to do that, because if I went on the streetcar, I had to walk a mile from Beverly Boulevard to Santa Monica Boulevard to catch the red car. Now, that's will give you a little idea of how stubborn I was. No way was I. See, in those days, today you don't mind girls that ride bicycles and that have braids down their backs and whatnot. In those days, we thought they were the most strange, peculiar people in the world. So here I am in Hollywood High. I wouldn't speak to anybody on the school grounds unless they spoke to me first. Do any of you understand that? Scared to death. Just scared to death. But I had a couple of friends that I made very shortly thereafter. And when I was a sophomore at Hollywood High, one of my friends gave me a dare. Do any of the women here know what it is to get a dare and not do it? This was the kind of a kid I was. You don't dare me to do anything. I'm apt to do it. She said, why don't you try out for one of the plays? And at that time, Hollywood High School was famed for its drama department. And a lot of our biggest stars have come out of that school. And it scared the living daylights out of me, but I will not take it there. So I did. I tried out for one of the plays, and I scared everybody to death and startled everybody to death because I got the part I tried out for. It even surprised me, if you want to know the truth. But you see, at that time, my mother was quite a well-known singer. And she, if this will interest you, I think, she was the second woman to sing The Merry Widow in New York when it first started. So I had a background of all of this music. And at an early age, I was started on the piano and with voice lessons and all that nonsense. And I made up my mind that I was going to try out for this play. And I did. And I got the part I tried out for, as I said. But that started something in me that nothing else under God's green earth could have started. And that's the only reason that I tell you this. Because in following that sort of a career, I had marvelous, marvelous coaching. And at that time, we had in Los Angeles what we called the Shakespearean contest. And you tried out for your school, and if you won that, you tried out for the city. And if you won that, you went up to Berkeley and tried out for the state, Berkeley University. And because I had marvelous coaching and a little background and perhaps some talent, I won all three. And it was a fantastic thing to happen to me because it gave me something that I could not have learned any other way. It taught me how to put up a front. And I hid behind that front for many, many, many years because it was the only way that I was comfortable. And when I went to UCLA, this will date me if nothing else ever does. It was on the old school on Vermont Avenue before it ever moved to Westwood. Any of you that know the University of University of California, Southern Branch it was called then, know exactly what I'm talking about. But at that time, there was a young man that was had been in Southern California for not too awfully long a time, that a lot of you have known over the years, called Chuck. Chuck C. is the way you know him. You know him only as Chuck C. because he never gave his last name, but all of you know it was Chuck Chamberlain. And here was this great big 6'1", handsome guy. I think he was the most beautiful man I had ever seen in my life. At that time, you all have remembered him as white-headed. At that time, he had the blackest hair you ever saw and the blackest eyes and a mouth that curled up at the corners. And I think all of you know exactly what happened to me. My career just went phooey, right out the window. Nothing would do, but this was the man of my dreams. The only love affair that I have ever had in my life. The only man that I have ever loved. And we soon decided to get married. And we had two children along the way, two boys. Strangely enough, 6 years apart. Now, I knew that Chuck drank, but I had no idea how much. Because, you see, in those days, he had come to California straight out of being a tremendous athlete. But there's a lot more to that story than that, because he came out here to California to commit suicide. I don't know whether any of you have heard Chuck tell this story or not, but it's quite a thing. Because he got hurt in football in high school, and he got what is ordinarily called a bone bruise, and he had osteomyelitis, and they wanted to cut off his leg. And it just killed him. The very thought of only being one-legged just absolutely destroyed him, because action was all that he knew. But by gosh, he came out here to California, and I'll be doggone if he didn't get well. And he died with the same leg that they wanted to cut off. But that's his story. Now, what about mine? What about my story in this crazy thing called life? As I said, I knew that he drank, but I had no idea how much. Because he had what I choose to call in those days, and I don't know whether I said this before, I might be repeating myself. He had what I choose to call a hollow leg. And every alcoholic in this room knows exactly what I'm talking about. Because he could drink and drink and drink and it wouldn't show. But since alcoholism is a progressive illness, and since it gets worse little by little and day by day as life goes on, it did just that. And every wife here at least knows exactly how I reacted to that. Not in a very nice way, because you see, in those days, we knew absolutely nothing about alcoholism. This was a long, long time ago. We got married in 1925. That's a long time ago, long time ago. So I fought it with everything that I had to fight it with, and I wasn't very nice about it. I got pretty ugly at times, and there were times, I remember very well, when I would sit at home alone just wondering what in heaven's name I was going to do about this man that I loved so much, but he had changed so. He wasn't like the man that I had married. And I tried everything. I even tried thinking about maybe there was something I could put in his drink that would get him so sick he'd never touch it again, which is what they're trying to do in some of these drying out places today, and I doubt very much if it ever works. Then I got to thinking, I got desperate enough to get to thinking, isn't there something I could put in his drink that would get rid of him? And I wouldn't get found out, you know? The crazy, crazy thoughts you have, fighting every inch of the way, trying to figure out something that would cause this man to do something about himself. But the only answer I ever got from Chuck was, "Let me alone, baby. I know exactly what I'm doing." And he thought he did. But the time finally came when it got so bad that I had to, whether I knew anything about it or not, I had to let go of that terrible necessity that he should change his pattern and do what I thought he ought to do. And strangely enough, even though I did it with a very, very lousy motive, because I hated it with every fiber of my being, he had become a periodic in those last 10 years, and there were sober periods in between his drinking bouts. And I can remember just as well as if it was yesterday. He was sitting on the couch on one side of the living room, and I was sitting on the other. And I told him that finally, after having threatened so many, many times to leave, that this time I had made up my mind and I was going to at least allow him the privilege to kill himself if he wanted to. We call that today letting go and letting God. I didn't let go with God. I let go with hate, with bitterness, with resentment, with every ugly motive that you can think of. But it worked exactly the same way. So I have to conclude that the bottom line is letting go. Letting go and allowing whoever is giving us problems the dignity and the privilege of finding their own answers in their own time, in their own way. It's not easy. It's the toughest thing I ever had to do in my life. But I went to a lawyer and I started divorce proceedings and I went to business school to try to learn some way to earn my own living because I had two kids and my mother to support. And you don't support them on a clerking at Bullock's or someplace like that. You have to have a decent profession in order to make enough money to take care of four people. But the funny part of it was that very shortly after I had made this decision, and he knew that I meant it for the first time in my life, he straightened up and flew right. And it's as simple as that. And I don't know how I can make it any more difficult because that's the way it was. And that's the way I think it works because I have watched it work time and time and time again. When you and I can let go of that terrible, god-awful necessity that other people should perform the way we think they should, we're in trouble until we can let go and allow them that dignity. And I can't call it anything but dignity because that's what it is. The dignity of being one of God's kids. The dignity to find our own answers in our own time, in our own way, because we're all different. All different. One of my very dear friends and Chuck's used to have a saying that it took me an awful long time to understand. He said, if God had made two of us exactly alike, one of us would be unnecessary. Think about that. It'll drive you nuts. How many times have all of you, I'm sure, because I think we all have followed pretty much the same path, how many times have you been in competition with and thought, everybody says competition is the life of trade, don't they? That's the thing that we're all working for, is to have a good competitive life and we're going to win. But you know, the funny part of it is that I watched Chuck, after he got sober, change his entire way of doing business for free and for fun. Damnedest thing I ever watched in my life. And I'd watch other salesmen stand around and say, how in the Sam Hill does he get this business? What has he got that I don't know about? He had this AA program is what he had. And it made life very, very different. I went to meetings with Chuck, AA meetings, for 6 long years before Al-Anon was born. So I go a long, long way back. And I've had a whale of a lot to learn. But I sat through those meetings, and I read the book from cover to cover time and time again. I thought it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever read in my life. And the chapter to wives and the family afterwards meant a great deal to me. And by the time 6 years were up and Lois Wilson came to the coast with a message, I had a lot of this stuff up here in my head, a lot of it. And Lois came out there with a terrific message for us, those of us who were the families of the alcoholics. She said she and Bill had been talking at great length about the necessity for us to find some way to live comfortably and peacefully with ourselves in spite of the alcoholic. See, this whole thing is in spite of. If you can remember that, don't remember that if you don't remember anything else. In spite of. Strange deal how it works. And she lit a fire under all of us that were sitting in the old 6300 Club on Wilshire Boulevard, across from the May Company. I know there's one guy here that remembers that very well. And we were enthralled, and she just lit a fire under all of us. And two of us were sitting at one of the tables, and we said, let's start a meeting in Beverly Hills. We were living in there and then, which we proceeded to do in my home. We didn't have any more idea what we were doing than the man on the moon. We had no program. We had nothing. We had the 12 steps, period. That was all. We started out, as some of you probably have experienced, talking about them. That was the sole topic of our conversation for quite a little while until we realized that them weren't doing us any good. And that we had to do something about ourselves, and what could we do to take these 12 steps and apply them to our very own livingness, so to speak. And we learned by guess and by gosh, by trial and error, by experience and its lesson. Just like the AAs learned in the beginning of AA. Now, we had the AA program, but we had to learn how to apply it to the non-alcoholic member, you see, which is a totally different deal. Because we had to learn to let go of the necessity that other people should perform, as I said, the way we thought they should. And get busy on ourselves, trying to get happy and peaceful and joyous in spite of. And that's quite a big deal, believe me. And it took a lot of learning and a lot of work. But after our groups had been going fairly successfully for several years, we sold our home in Beverly Hills and moved to Laguna Beach, where we live today. And that's a horse of another color. It seems to me my life has always been cut in segments, and each segment is a little different from the other ones, and you have to learn a whole new way of handling things. It's real crazy, but we are not people who adjust easily. I have found that out, and I don't care whether you're an alcoholic or whether you're an Al-Anon, non-alcoholic. The thing that I have seen so clearly for so long, and there are probably some alcoholics here that won't like this, but I'm going to say it anyway. The more I live in this program, the more I see how much we are like the alcoholic, those of us who marry them. Because the sober people and the people without any problems just bore us to death. Took me a long time to realize that, but it's true. I can remember one time I belonged to a bridge club for many, many years that I loved very dearly because it filled in during the time that Chuck was drinking so much and gave me something to do with my friends, at least. And I can remember being invited to spend a weekend with them, and I was so bored I couldn't stand it. Thought I'd die. All they talked about was a lot of nonsense, you know. But then I had to remember that in the beginning, the alcoholics bored me too, because I thought that nothing was, it was always the same thing over and over and over and over again. Same stuff, same stuff, same stuff. And I'd say, my God, can't you think of anything different, you know? And I'd get so bored with the bunch of people that would come to our house after meetings and sit there and talk and talk and talk. And every time they came, it'd be the same sort of thing. How to work this program, really, is what it was. And I finally knew that I was going to have to do something about myself during that time. And I had the good sense to start to listen. Makes a lot of difference when you're listening. But when you're criticizing and making book and looking down your nose at something, nothing ever gets to you, never gets through to you. So here we are, we moved to, Chuck had been sober, I guess, oh, maybe 14, 15 years by that time. He'd been the second delegate from Southern California to New York. And I thought we had it, thought we'd made. He'd gotten back in business and everything was just going fine. And we finally had the wherewithal to buy the home of our dreams in Laguna Beach, high on a hill with a perfectly beautiful view of the little town of Laguna and the ocean and Catalina Island. And I thought we had it made. Everything was just absolutely perfect. Couldn't be better. But I didn't count on the fact that Chuck's business was still in Los Angeles. And he was going in every day. Now, Laguna Beach, if you don't know it, is about halfway between Los Angeles and San Diego. It's quite a ways from Los Angeles, an hour's drive, good hour's drive, sometimes more, depending on the traffic. And by that time, Chuck had become a tremendously popular speaker. And he was doing a lot of 12-step work also. So instead of coming home for dinner, as I'd been used to having him come to Beverly Hills, he was going out and grabbing a sandwich or something and going to wherever he was talking. And here I sit in my dream house. My kids are grown and gone. I don't know a soul in Laguna. There's no Al-Anon in Laguna. In fact, there was no Al-Anon in Orange County to speak of. There was one meeting in Corona del Mar and one in Santa Ana, and that was it. Today, it's just lousy with meetings all over the place. All over the place. But then there were no meetings to speak of. There was the AA meeting was in Laguna, but that was it. And I was so bored and so discouraged and so lonely, I just thought I'd die. And I began to put pressure on Chuck to slow down. I'll bet there are a lot of wives here that know exactly what I'm talking about. And this is the reason that I tell this. Because there are lots and lots of wives, and husbands too, who say to their mates, "My God, you've been going to meetings all these years and talking, talking, talking. Isn't time that you slowed down and gave me a little more attention?" I'll bet there are a lot of wives in this room that know exactly what I'm talking about. And I got so jealous of this program, I just thought I'd die. And Chuck tried. He tried very desperately to slow down, and he would only talk maybe once or twice a week, whereas he'd been talking 4 and 5 and sometimes 6 nights a week. And he'd say, "No, I can't talk tonight. My wife is very lonely. I have to stay home and keep her company." And make me feel like a fool, if you want to know the truth. He did that for about 6 months, and then he got so uncomfortable he couldn't stand it. And Thanksgiving came along, and the kids were there for dinner, and we were all sitting around the table, and Chuck said, "I've got to say something." He said, "I've seen how desperately lonely your mother has been, and I've tried very hard to slow down and give her more of my attention, but," he said, "I'm getting so uncomfortable I can't stand it." He said, "I owe this program my life. This is my life. This is my love. This is my dedication. And whatever I have to do in order to keep that feeling in this program, I have got to do it, and you will have to adjust yourself to that." And he gave me an ultimatum. What do you do? What do you do? If you're anything like me, you walk the floor for several days, crying and wondering what in heaven's name you can do about yourself, and finally coming to the understanding that you only have 2 things that you can do. Only 2, that's all. You can stay or you can leave. And here I am, a girl without anything to earn my own living. I had passed the age when I could do the things that I had been used to doing in the acting field. And I'm 40-some years old. What do you do? You walk the floor and cry and walk the floor and cry, and all of a sudden you begin to remember something. The first year of Chuck's sobriety, when he was asked to talk on Christmas. I can't get by without telling this, because this is the thing that changed my whole being, my whole attitude, you see. And I raised hell, wouldn't you? After all, Christmas is a family day, isn't it? And he should be there. Well, if you know Chuck, you know that when he makes a date, he keeps it unless he's too ill to go. So I planned an early dinner, much against my will and better judgment. And the children were there. And the thing that makes me laugh today, and one of the things I want to say before I forget it, for God's sake, any of you Al-Anon gals, if you're as serious as I used to be, try your damned best to develop a sense of humor. Please do. Please do. The ability to laugh at yourself. Because this is what I had to learn. Because you see, in seeing this, I remembered that very shortly after we'd finished dinner, our kids all took off. They had a lot of friends and a lot of open houses they wanted to go to on Christmas. So they came early to dinner and stayed for a little while and then left. And we were left alone anyway. So I got dressed and went down to the meeting, which was in Santa Monica, 26th and Broadway. If any of you have ever gone to that meeting is still going. This was a lot of years ago. And at that meeting, there were two very, very drunk winos that were sitting right here in the front row. They'd just been pulled out from under the Santa Monica Pier. And they were noisy, as drunks are wont to be. And they kept interrupting Chuck. And I can remember to this day how kind he was. Because, you see, he understood where they were coming from. And he would quiet them down and go on talking. And he was just as dear and sweet as he could be. Then I began to remember the next year. I'm all seeing this walking back and forth in my living room. Same thing. He was asked to talk on Christmas. And I went a little more willingly this time, not too much so. But lo and behold, one of those winos was leading that meeting, and the other one read the steps. And they had been sober that entire year. And they told us afterwards that they had not heard one word that, or not remembered anyway, one word that Chuck had said that year before. They were too drunk. But the thing they did remember was that a husband and wife would leave their kids on Christmas and come to an AA meeting. And I saw something that I had never been able to see before. Sometimes it takes something pretty rough to wake us dumb non-alcoholics up. Because we are a bunch of dummies until we get smart. And that's what this program's all about, because this program is teaching us for the first time in our lives to be pretty smart. When we begin to know ourselves a little better, and we find a way to live comfortably and peacefully with ourselves in spite of you alcoholics, we begin to get pretty well. We begin to get along pretty well. But the thing that happened after that was that my youngest son had just come home from Korea. He was just let go from the service. And he was just in a terrible state because we had sold our home in Beverly Hills while he was away in the Army. And he came home and he had no home. And he was in a strange house that he had never seen before. And he was very, very uncomfortable. But he had the sense and the good judgment to give me a piece of advice that I will be grateful for the rest of my days. He said, "Mom, why don't you start another Al-Anon group?" And I said, "But I don't know anybody down here." "Oh," he said, "for God's sake, you must know somebody that you say hi to at the grocery store. You go to the AA meetings with Chuck all the time, with your dad, with Dad all the time. Why don't you get busy and see if you can't start a meeting at home like you did up in Beverly Hills?" And he did something for me that I wouldn't take $1 million for, because that was the beginning of the Laguna Beach Monday Noon Al-Anon group, which has saved my life, completely saved my life. And I'm not going to go on too awfully much longer, but there are some things here that I want to tell you, because they were things that I had to grow into. Why it is that we have so damn much pride that we can't tell people exactly what makes us tick and just exactly what we're like inside. We don't want anybody to know. And I had built up that tremendous facade. And what I had to learn to do was to pull that facade down to the place where it wasn't so damnably important and pull my self-worth up until I got comfortable with me. And that's the only thing that has saved my marriage and saved my life. Because from then on, I became teachable, you see. And I remembered so well what Friend Ernest had said that was many, many years before. If God had made two of us exactly alike, one of us would be unnecessary. And I had to begin to see that it was up to me, as an individual, to find my own answers in my own time and my own way, with your help. And little by little, it began to show up as something that I could get my teeth into. And I think every one of you knows exactly what I'm talking about. Because I knew from then on that I could do something about me and be comfortable about it and not care what you think. Isn't that something else? I grew up caring so much about what you thought that I never was comfortable with me, you see. It was so important to me that I be all these things that I thought were necessary in order to be quite a gal, you know. It's so stupid, it's ridiculous, you know. And he also went on to say that if you will just do the best you can with what you have, one silly, simple day at a time, to the best of your then ability, you'll begin to learn more and more and more as you go on. And there are a lot of things that have happened with me, a lot of things. I've learned a lot about letting go and letting God, which is something I talked about a lot, but I never really practiced. And it took a whale of a lot of honesty on my part, because you see, I'd been such a damn liar all my life. I was a cover-up artist. I wasn't about to let you know exactly what I was like inside, because I didn't think you'd approve or like me. So I had to put on a front. And I carried that front for many, many years, until I got so uncomfortable I couldn't carry it any longer. And I think that's what happens to us as well as to the alcoholic. And I don't think it makes a bit of difference. I sometimes think that we non-alcoholics have a rougher time finding out what's troubling us than you alcoholics do, because it doesn't show that much, you see. The thing, that place where we are so much like you is inside. Because that's where we feel it the most. And I found out that the very fact that I had to learn to take my hands off of other people's lives, because I've made some awful mistakes in that area. And I knew that our eldest son, who is 6 years older than Richard, I thought he had a problem, but I wasn't absolutely sure, because his problem was much different from Chuck's. Chuck was a whiskey bed drinker, and Bill was a martini lunch drinker. Totally different. He's never had a 502. He's never been arrested. He got himself in trouble with his wife a lot, but that's, isn't that the usual? I think that's the usual. But we, neither one of us, were too sure that he really had a problem, but we kind of thought he did, because he was on the... He had a wall up. He had a wall up, and he resented any interference in his life. Any criticism of any kind, he resented. So I was kind of sure that he had a problem. And finally, as time went on, his wife left him. Oh, the thing that I should tell you, I guess, is that at the insistence of his wife, Chuck said he would talk to Bill. And he invited him down, and he came down one afternoon and sat there all afternoon listening to Chuck tell his own story. See, that's the thing Chuck always did. I have never yet heard Chuck give advice. He always said, I did it this way, and that was the result. And people had to take interest in or believe what he had to say. But Bill sat there until about 5:30 in the afternoon, and Chuck quit finally. And Bill said, yeah, I know, I probably am an alcoholic, but I think I can handle it. He handled it off and on for a couple more years. And then his wife left him, and he lost two jobs in a row. And he and his brother had never been very good friends because they were so different. Bill's life was all athletics and business, and of course Richard's life was all art, music, and drama. And he thought he had a nut for a brother. But do you know who the first person was that he went to after he decided to do something about himself? He went to Richard. And they threw their arms around each other and cried. The first time that they had ever made any effort at becoming friends, real friends. And from there he went to Johnny H. Because Johnny had been very, very close to Chuck and me. We call him one of our sons. We both stood up with him when he and Dottie got married as his mother and father. And we've loved him very dearly for many, many years. And Bill went to him, and he is now, and has been for a long time, has been Bill's sponsor. Bill had to come to the point, just like every alcoholic has to, where he has no place else to go. Sick and tired of being sick and tired. And he is loving every living minute of it. And he's having the time of his life. Just a beautiful, beautiful time. Of course, it did funny things to his second marriage, but there are still those people out there who are not interested in either AA or Al-Anon and who don't like it very much. That are very, very ambitious, and they want a lot of things that the alcoholics are not interested in anymore, you see. Places, things, people, position, power, all those nonsensical things that we have had such a hard time finding out aren't worth a damn. But that they usually come as a result of practicing this program in your daily affairs one day at a time, simply, lovingly, and joyously. It's fantastic. I also have one of Bill's kids that has been giving me a lot of trouble for a long, long time. His daughter. She's the eldest, and there were two boys also. And she's been out in the dope scene for many, many, many years. She claims that she's an alcoholic also, but I rather doubt that, but I'm keeping my big mouth shut. That's something I've had to learn that you have taught me to do, because there was a time when I didn't do that too well. But she's maybe 3-4 months ago, ostensibly I say because I don't know, celebrated her first year in AA. So I've got quite a bunch of them. Fortunately, the other boy doesn't have any problem in that line. Thank God. You know, the funny part of it is, and this just kills me when I think about it, maybe you have kids that are so different as my two are, and you find out at long last that the thing you have thought wasn't at all. Now, the youngest one looks like me, thinks like his father. The eldest one looks like his father, thinks like me. And I don't know. And, of course, there are differences in that, too. That's not a whole complete truth, but it's awful close to it. But at any rate, they're all doing pretty well. I'm so proud of Bill. I could just... He went with me up to Canada just a short while back. And they just loved him up there. And he's going with me to a couple of places. He's doing a little talking now. And you know, the funny part of it is he sounds a lot like his dad. In a lot of ways, he does. He's giving a good talk. Good talk. And he's a sweet guy. And so is the other one. And I'm so proud of my family, I don't know what to do, but I'm more proud of you people. Because, you see, you have given me something that I could not possibly have learned any other way. You've given me the ability to live joyously, peacefully, and comfortably with me, in spite of. So I can give you nothing but pure, unadulterated gratitude. God bless you. Thank you.